Hi, and welcome to the Financial Planner Life podcast, where we talk to professionals at varying stages in their career about what it's like working in the wonderful world of financial planning and financial advice. This podcast is proudly sponsored by Recruit UK, a recruitment consultancy specifically focused on the financial services. They have a niche specialism, recruiting, within the financial planning industry, so check out their website for the latest job opportunities, hints and tips, and blog articles. And today's guest is Stephen Pine. He is one of the managing partners of Holden & Partners in London. And today he talks about the realities of running your own directly authorised practice and really what to expect when you move into the world of self-employment. He himself didn't want to feel like a cog in the wheel of a larger machine, so decided to set up Holden & Partners, but 15 years ago decided to specialise in ethical and sustainable investments. And back then you were considered a bit of an oddball to do that, whereas these days you're at a bit of an oddball if you're not looking at sustainable and ethical investments. And we talk about the realities of running your own practice, understanding your niche, and how you can use that to stand out, to generate new clients and new referral opportunities. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Stephen, thanks so much for joining me today on the Financial Planner Life podcast. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks, Sam. It's pretty busy time for us with the budget coming up on the 3rd of March and then the end of the tax year pretty swiftly after that. So it's kind of all hands on deck, plus, you know, kids at home, homeschooling. So life is pretty busy at the moment. But, you know, I'm not complaining. I think we're quite lucky compared with a lot of people. So, all in all, pretty good. Really?
Pretty good. Thanks. Pretty good going. Standard sort of stuff at the moment for a financial planner, I suppose. Yeah. End of tax year is pretty manic anyway, but chucking, like you say, lockdown and looking after kids and everything. I bet the news yesterday about the 8th of March being returned to school was an absolute blessing. It certainly was for me, having a little 4-year and a half year old daughter who's running us ragged at home.
Yeah. It's I think what a lot of people have been waiting for, who've got, you know, young children at home. So it's a big relief. Yeah, not just for me, but for, you know, lots of people who are in our business, who've been sort of trying to juggle the workload of so-called, in inverted covers, teaching their children.
Yeah. I haven't done much teaching, to be honest. I'm going to be guilty.
I think that's mainly done by women in the household, so I'm told. But I think it's an impossible task, really. It's just it comes down to trying to keep them off the screen as much as possible in some ways.
Absolutely.
Children, I think we've all learned that teachers perform a very valuable role in society, and
100%.
Kids should be in school. So
100%, I totally agree with you there. So Stephen, thanks so much for agreeing to come onto the podcast. Sort of as mentioned before, and just to kind of reiterate if no one knows, but the Financial Planner Life podcast is all about understanding the career of those that work within the financial planning profession. So what's really always interesting to me is to bring somebody on that's ran their own business, built their own financial planning practice. So not just being an employee, not that's a problem, but obviously running a business is very different from being an employee, and also hiring individuals, hiring financial planners, building a team around you, running the marketing, all the things that you do when you run your own business. I mean, you spin a million and one plates. So
it's
really interesting to understand the realities, really. And that's the point of today, is just to find out really about you, what you've done in your career, some of the sort of perhaps paths you wouldn't tread again, and perhaps you could warn a few people about.
Loads of those.
Well, that's the thing, trial and error, isn't it, when you run your own business, without a shadow of a doubt. Cool. So you are managing director of Holden Partners in London. I mean, like 12 years ago, I think we placed a candidate with you, actually, quite some time back. So you've been around for a while now. How long?
Been around for a while, scarily. Yeah, it goes very quickly. But yeah, with 2003, we started. So it's a while ago.
Fab. Okay. Right. So let's just kind of go back then. Let's go straight to Holden & Partners. We don't have to talk about too deep about your career up until that point, but let's talk about Holden & Partners. What made you set up Holden & Partners, and how did it come about?
Well, I was working quite closely with three other guys, and we were at quite a large IFA, and, you know, we got to a point where, you know, I guess we were the large firm got bought out by a big bank, and we we were at the point where we were thinking, well, do we really want to be part of a large organization, just a cog in the wheel? Mm. It feels a bit alien to us. And we kind of went on walks at lunchtime, back in the days when you worked in the office, that was, and had a bit of a moan about it. And then we thought to ourselves, well, why don't we do our own thing? If we're going to be moaning about it all the time, we might as well go for it ourselves. So after a couple of months of planning and speaking to various people who'd kind of done similar things before, we got our business off the ground, and we got a guy, Peter Holden, who'd retired kind of prematurely, but he'd set up his own business, so he had quite a lot of experience. So we, there were five of us, we got together, started as out of a one-room office up in Highgate. Okay. And we grew sort of fairly gradually from there, and it was 2003 was an exciting year. Starting your own business is very exciting.
No, absolutely, I agree with you there. And running my own recruitment business myself, I don't think I'd have it any other way. I don't think I could go back to being an employee.
No.
Let's just go back a little bit further then. So you guys were employed then, were you, at the time when this bank came in and purchased the business that
we were employed, and the bank bought the financial advisory firm out completely. So we were then effectively employees of the bank.
Okay.
And we were keen on ethical and environmental investment, but the bank really didn't have any plans for that, or they were paying lip service to it. So that was another sort of factor in our thinking, that they weren't really taking what we were keen on seriously. So
Okay, so your employees, you came together, you had a bit of a whinge and a moan, you weren't keen on being taken over by this bank, you didn't want to feel like a cog in the wheel, as you expressed. I understand that feeling.
Yeah, that's right.
You can absolutely move on in life being stuck in this cog in the wheel mode and being quite resentful. But it takes a certain somebody to step outside of that and then set their own business and carve their own path, doesn't it? You mentioned there about ethical investments, though, being something of interest to you then back in early 2000, by the sounds of it.
Yeah. So this was 2003. Yeah. So the company before had specialised in ethical and environmental investment, and it was something that we felt quite strongly about even then, even though a lot of people thought it was a bit odd and slightly, quirky. Mm. However, it was something that we believed in from a relatively early stage in its development. So that was another thing which kind of drove our decision to do our own thing.
Okay. So were you running your own investment strategies around ethical investments, your own portfolios, or were you sort of tapping into others?
We were working quite closely with a couple of firms of stockbrokers who had the same specialism. And we were just using a limited range of ethical funds, really, to put our own portfolios together. Back in 2003, the universe of ethical and environmental funds was much smaller than it is now. So, putting a portfolio together on the face of it was a relatively simple job, because there weren't many alternatives to choose from. So, we're quite proud of the fact, I guess, that it's something that has always been a big part of what we do. And it's something that really has helped drive our development over the last 15 or 16 years.
I'm always intrigued to understand as to why, because not every financial planner has that same sort of passion, if you like, or enthusiasm for ethical and now the more trendy impact investment opportunities.
Yeah.
So why was it so important to you that if you were to go and run and set your own business, that you were leading with ethical investment solutions for your clients?
It's Charlie. I'm sorry to interrupt you mid-episode, but I had an idea, and if you've been thinking about it, I might just have the answer. If you've been sat here thinking, I need more support in my career, I don't have access to everything I need to put me on this career trajectory all these guests on the podcast have, I know where you need to go, and you need to click the link in the description, which will take you to the Financial Planner Life Academy. This is the first fully independent academy. You'll have access to all the resources you need for all of your qualifications, plus soft skills training, live Q&As with experts, and a load of career advice in there as well. I won't keep you any longer, so you can get back to the episode, but click that link in the description if I've made you curious.
I think it was twofold, really. It was driven by the fact that we believed in it as an investment opportunity in its own right. It always felt that if you can make money from, you know, wind and the sun, then why would you spend, you know, a fortune extracting it from the ground with all the environmental consequences that go with that? So we thought it was just an obvious investment opportunity. I mean, I guess it sounds a bit sort of smug in a way now saying that, but it felt like the right thing to do. And it was also the ethics of it. You know, I've always been interested in the environment. I can remember, you know, being a member of Greenpeace when I was sort of 14. So it's something that's always interested me. So there are a couple of reasons behind it, really. It was like, we just thought it was an opportunity to make money, but also, you know, the whole ethical side of it, you know, being the right thing to do, also appealed to us.
So clients at the time were also asking about ethical investments, or were you using it almost as a kind of unique selling point to how you were delivering financial planning?
It's, you know, some clients wouldn't have touched it with a barge pole, or they wouldn't have touched it with tweezers. So you know, it was never going to be the right thing for them. We weren't particularly evangelical about it. We just offered it as an option. It was there in the background. You know, we asked the questions whether people were interested in it, and you can always structure the questions in a way that could be, you know, pushing them down that road. But ultimately, we let clients sort of arrive at their own conclusions as to whether it was right for them. Yeah.
Okay, great stuff. Okay, well, let's just kind of go back to the setting up of that business then, the mindset that you were in. Excuse me, there's a very loud motorbike going past.
Yeah, it sounded like it.
There
not particularly
go.
Ethical.
No, not particularly ethical. Perhaps it's a sign. Yeah. So let's go back then to when you set that business up, okay? Because let's say someone's having a listen to this podcast now. Perhaps they feel like a cog in the wheel, Stephen. Mm. Perhaps they feel like they're undervalued. They're not adding the value that they want. The proposition they're following, the company they're following, isn't what they believe in. I get talking to these people all the time. You run your own financial planning business. It's in central London. And obviously you help financial planners break away from that employed model, or perhaps move from one company where they're self-employed, where it's not quite right for them. And you're looking to help them come into your business and grow with you. So what do you think, when it comes to mindset around somebody about the changing from, say, employed to self-employed, what advice would you give somebody when they're thinking about making that transition from employed to self-employed?
If they're looking to set up their own business, you mean?
So if they're looking to, so you've got the options, haven't you? You can either kind of be, let's say you're employed and you want to go, you want that independence, you want to run your own business. Now the routes you can kind of go down, isn't it? You could be self-employed. So you could be a self-employed registered individual. You could be self-employed, set up an AR firm and have your own branding. You could go directly authorized. Okay. All those things that independence you're looking for in respect of your managing your own destiny when it comes to your recruitment. But each of those three routes, if you like, can be very different and different levels of responsibility are required to do so. But if someone's sat there, they're employed and they've got these ambitions, you've been there, you've done that, going back on yourself, what advice would you give that person to think about before they took the leap into one of those, say, three options?
I would say don't go into it lightly. Thinking that it's a passport to an easier life. You've got to go into it thinking it's going to be really hard work, and you are going to be, you know, living and breathing it, you know, 24 hours a day. That's one thing to have at the front of your mind. The other thing is that you you're taking a risk. You're backing yourself. You know, you're not going to be relying on anyone else. You've got to have the courage of your convictions. You've got to be pretty clear about what you're doing what you're offering. And you know, you've got to be very determined, and you're going to get a lot of knockbacks. You're going to, and a lot of things are going to go wrong, but you're going to have to be prepared to learn from them, and you know, grow with your business. And I think probably you see a lot of stuff written about running your own business, and you know, all these great entrepreneurs, blah 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 blah. And perhaps some of them gloss over a bit on, you know, how hard it is to run a business. You know, once you take on the responsibility of looking after other people, you know, looking after other people's money. Obviously, if you're a financial advisor, it's hard, but it's incredibly rewarding, because you are building something that is yours, or you are a major part of. So, you know, the upsides clearly are the flexibility, but the knowledge that you are, you know, part of something that you are growing, and you know, it's your thing, or whoever else you are in business with. So you know, I would say a bit of wisdom that was imparted to me when we were setting up, and I was asking people's advice. I spoke to someone who'd run a few businesses himself, and I just said to him, "What's the one thing you would say to me just before we started?" And he said, "Well, just don't spend too much time running the business." And that is something that can easily happen. You can just get sucked into, you know, administration, building an infrastructure. But you've got to go out and generate the income. If you don't do that, if you get sucked into everything else too quickly, you're never going to have a business. So that was one sage piece of advice. Don't spend too much time running the business. So yeah, and the other thing I would say is that I recently read an autobiography by the guy who started Nike, actually, which was it changed my perceptions of Nike, and it's just very kind of warts and all about running a business, and the how many mistakes you make, and how close you are to the edge sometimes, you know. So I think that would be a good book to read.
So that the guy who set up Nike, so it was really reasonable. It wasn't this kind of perceptive idea that he set it up and it was all easy. It was hard, and he was very close to the edge.
He was close to going bankrupt several times. You know, there was last minute finance deals, you know, things not quite working when they were supposed to. And you know, for the first couple of years, that's how it is.
Yeah.
But you know, it's your thing. You're growing your own thing. So it's incredibly rewarding. But with that comes, you know, the responsibility and the fact that, you know, you can't walk away from it.
No. And I think there's this misconception as well, is that when you run your own business, you've got this lovely little lifestyle that you can lead, and it's all, you probably have more free time on your hands than you ever done. But actually, there's that, when you are employed, although you might think, oh God, you know, you might worry about losing your job or something like that. I suppose there are fears and things associated, but you can walk away, close the door if you wanted to, and not have to think about things that a business owner has to think about.
Yeah. I mean,
sometimes running a business, it's on my mind 24/7. I had to do a lot of work around it. You know, I had to really let go of a few things, like fears and stuff around it, because it was like controlling me. You know, I was trying to control people in it, because it was like I was fearful that it was going to collapse around me at any moment. And I realized
that's the thing. Yeah, you do live in, and that's kind of what drives you to a certain extent. You are, people sometimes say to me, oh, you know, do you look and feel, you know, really glad and you know, proud of what you've done. So the answer is, well, not really, because I'm, you know, or we're worried that it could fall over at any day, and it might go horribly wrong. So those things are always in the back of your mind. They just are, and I think that's what drives a lot of businesses.
So what would you say are the main things? So you're a directly authorized business, aren't you?
Yeah.
So what would you say are the main things that kept you awake at night that perhaps you've now dealt with and you wish you knew sooner?
The main things. that's an interesting question. There's, you know, when you're in a, you're running your own financial advisory business. We invested in a couple of things that were quite high risk early on. I mean, there were small, very small parts of client portfolios, and it was done in the completely right way. It was investments in renewable energy, and the clients knew the risks, and we put very small amounts of money into them. But, you know, some of them didn't work out, and the clients were very understanding about it because they went into it with open eyes. But you do worry about that sort of thing. You know, you feel bad about it. So that, you know, there's that side of it. Fortunately, touch wood, we've never had to make people redundant. So, that's something we haven't had to deal with. But we have had to make some difficult decisions on people who haven't worked out for the right reason. So that's pretty uncomfortable. Okay. Getting PI sometimes has been a bit of a worry. Getting PI cover, especially now. You know, so that's like, that has been a few days where we've been thinking, well, you know, are we going to be all right here? Not that we've got much to hide or worry about, really, but you can't help thinking, is it going to be all right? So there's things like that.
Okay, cool. Okay, well, there's a fair few things there, isn't there? When you talk about PI cover, have you ever thought about, obviously PI cover is going up for directly authorized firms, IFAs especially are feeling the pinch when it comes to PI. I mean, has it ever sort of made you think directly authorized, perhaps I should just drop it and go down the AR route, keep your brand and just let someone else do that for you? Or is it really, really important that you're directly authorized? Is it a necessity to be that way?
I think it comes down to, in a way, it's what drives you. It's a similar thing to what drives you to set up your own business. It's about, you know, doing your own thing and being responsible to yourself and your business partners and not having anyone else telling you what to do. I think if, we have had thought about it, but you're going to compromise your independence. You know, you're going to have to fall into line with someone else. So, we're not going to be able to move as quickly. We're going to have to run things by a different business. You know, it's just going to have a big impact on how we operate and what we're able to do and the service we'll be able to provide to our clients. So, it's important to us that we maintain our independence.
Okay, so you are a company that's been around for quite some time, and I mean, how many are there of you in total, including employees?
I think there are 28 of us, 29 of us, something like that. Yeah,
29 of you. Okay, and how many financial planners?
So there's 9 financial planners. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you mentioned there as well that kind of, when perhaps the books aren't balancing great or there's certain worries and things coming in and you're thinking somebody's underperforming, that you might have to make redundancies or you might have to get rid of somebody. And it's never a very comfortable conversation to have with anybody. You know, you wish everybody in your business can do well, but that's not the case. And that's part of growing a business, isn't it? And we learn a lot around the hiring process, the types of people that we take on. And hard as we try, I think, in the interview stage, someone can absolutely nail an interview, can't they? You think there, God, I found the right guy here or girl. And then so many months later, it's like, what? This is not the same person. So it becomes a real difficult sort of process of trying to hire the right people. So
it does. Yeah, it does. Yeah.
What's your sort of thoughts around that? So if we think about growing your business, what kind of process do you take when it comes to hiring new financial planners, for instance? What do you do? Do you do a role play? How do you establish whether or not they're the right fit for your business?
Well, but some of the people our younger financial advisors have kind of come through the business. So we know them. You know, two of them have been a paraplanner with us, so we know what they're like. Two others, it's a slightly different route. So they've been financial advisors elsewhere, and you have to interview them thoroughly. You have to get a range of people to meet with them, so you're not just getting one or two opinions. So you've got to do role plays. You've got to try and delve into their background a bit, see what's driving them, what ambitions they have. You've got to spend time with them to get to know them. really. And ultimately, it's a group decision, but you are taking a bit of a gamble because you just don't know how it's going to work out. So you've got to do a very thorough job, but it's never totally guaranteed to work out. So a role play would be a big part of it. We would be getting them to meet people at different levels in the business so that we get a variety of opinions on what that person is like and whether we think they will fit in with the culture and what we're looking to do as a business.
So, you know, in the news, you see a lot about, and I talk a lot about my podcast now, but about the advisor gap. So, you know, not only is there an advice gap, but there's an advisor gap. You know, there's going to be a fair few advisors leaving the industry in the next 5 to 10 years. You mentioned two sort of routes there where normally a financial planning firm would grow through almost like a mini acquisition. They'd look at another financial planner from another firm. What could they bring to the table? What clients could they bring? And that was historically how financial planning firms grew, just sort of taking experienced financial planners. Now, a survey came out with Octopus and it was like most financial planners now believe that they're going to have to be taking financial planners from other professions. So people that are people who are level 4 qualified, but they're working in marketing, for example, and thinking, right, we need to be able to bring these guys into the profession and train them up to become financial planners. Or you've got the traditional route, which you know of, which is like administration into power planning. And you alluded to that there, that some of your planners have come through that sort of traditional ground root level training route, if you like. So what I'd really like to understand from your perspective is, how do you feel about those routes then? You know, you've got less and less financial planners out there. So your pool of attracting financial planners with experience gets less and less and less. Then you've got the other side, which is say the admin power planner financial advisor route, or you've got picking somebody that's level 4 qualified from another profession. What's your experience, or, you know, have you hired that way in those three areas? So, or have you always just focused on experienced planners? I know you had some internal ones that you've hired up. I guess the point that I'm trying to get here, because I'm sort of wobbling on right now.
Yeah.
Do you see somebody coming through, say, admin power planner route as being as good as an experienced financial planner? Would be my first question.
I think the advantage of developing your own is that you know them and they know the business, and it's comfortable. So, you know, you go at your own pace, and you know, it's much less of a gamble. So if you've got people in your business that want to go down the route of becoming an advisor, then I would be going down that route. It's you know, you could take someone from another industry without experience, but I don't see why you would be training them straight away to becoming an advisor if you've got people in your business who want to do that job already and know the industry, know the business, you know, have the exams already. So I would, you know, we've got people who've changed careers, who've come into our business, you know, as administrators, you know, as junior investment people, and, you know, they work their way up that way. So that's kind of what we would do, I think. I don't think we would just take someone who we feel is potentially very good as an advisor, but doesn't really have any track record or means of proving that.
Because you've got the likes of St. James's Place, for example, even Quilter playing around with it with their advisor school, where it's not unusual for them now to do that, is to take somebody from another profession, put them through the academy and sit them underneath a partner practice, and then really fast track them straight into financial planning. And their excuse and their reason for that is they believe that the skills and attributes are transferable to becoming a planner, and not everybody needs to go down that admin route. And sometimes some of the people that are coming across without experience, but the attributes and skills, also have really good client access. So perhaps they've come from an environment where they are with high net worth individuals, or they've built strong relationships with people that they could instantly sort of turn into clients. So there's this kind of argument for fast tracking those types of people. And then you've got people that sit in the camp of, right, well, yeah, if you're an administrator, are you learning it from grassroots level? You're becoming a power planner and you're kind of going up that way. I see that route being really good for say somebody straight out of university, maybe mm-hmm. a graduate, and then step, and then they can see that. And I had a guy on the podcast who went to Rathbones as an apprentice, and at 16 years old, did a 2-year apprenticeship there. 21 was level 4 qualified. He's only working as a client executive, like administrator stroke sort of customer service type role within Rathbones, but he's now chartered. He's got one exam away from fellow and he's 23 and he's still not a financial planner, but I can see that route was perfect for him and he's learned everything along the way. But somebody who's like shit out at their job elsewhere, I've got loads of transferable skills, just aren't going to start at a level of like 20k basic salary in the future, because they're used to earning like 40-50k. So I see that there is this gap there, you know, and I can see what SJP are doing and all of that, they're trying to fill it, but I wonder if it's as sort of open to the rest of the financial planning companies that are out there. And obviously we've got small to medium enterprises within the financial planning world, haven't we? They're not massive firms that can invest heavily in that time with training and development.
I think that's the thing. It's you know, if you're St. James's Place, you've got, you know, resources. You've got a whole academy. With a business like ours, you have limited resources. So if you're taking someone on who's got no experience, you know, how are you going to look after that person for 18 months or however long it's going to be? What are they going to do that's going to contribute to the business from day one? Because you're going to have to pay them, you know, a decent salary, and you know, you're going to have people looking after them, really, on a sort of full-time basis. So I think you have to be a business of a certain size to be able to offer that route, because, you know, you can't just take someone on and then wonder what you're going to do with them each day because they haven't got any experience. So, you know, I could see perhaps that maybe, you know, you could have someone shadowing partners for 6 months or so, but you know, I just think it's got to be a properly structured program where there are dedicated people to look after them. Otherwise, they're going to feel, you know, like a bit of a spare part, and so I think you've got to be quite a big business to offer that.
There are certain types of trainers that are now coming out. There's a guy called Michael Pashley, who's just created a practical investment planning qualification. So if someone's like level 4 qualified and they don't have experience of the practical skills, so they've got the theory, but not the practical skills. So you do this practical investment planning qualification, which is like the equivalent to a level 6.
Yeah.
And you have like the guys who check over all your work and everything like that, the examiners, like official examiners, about 100 hours of work. But you are sort of assessed on your practical skills in a role play scenario. And all of that's like videoed and everything. And actually, when you kind of get it and you pass it, you get given this sort of pack and it shows everything. So if you almost went to an employer and said, look, I'm ready to become a financial planner, I'm going to take away some of the training needs from you guys. Here's my evidence up to level 6 that I've delivered practical, structured financial planning, and I understand what these individual things are. I think that type of thing helps close that gap. But also that sort of stuff can be then used towards CAS status to help speed the process up. So I think there has to be something done, because I think like firms of your size where, you know, it's difficult, isn't it? How are you supposed to take on like people like that? You're gonna struggle. And I suppose historically the banks would have done all that, wouldn't they? They'd have trained them.
They would have done. You know, people came, a lot of them have come through banks. Yeah. I look around and the people we've got in our business, and I think probably the majority of them have started in some sort of administrative capacity somewhere. You know, they've got a foot in the door somewhere, and they've kind of gone from there. Yeah,
which I think, and I speak to a lot of people who've done that, and they've made quite, you know, they've been quite successful. You know, and we work with financial planning firms to sort of suggest that and create a trainee route that way. So start them off as admin, move them into power planning, but with the promise of becoming financial planners within a specific time frame, as opposed to just kind of, then you've got the argument when they're decent power planners, no one wants to remove a decent power
planner. Well, that's difficult as well. You have to strike a balance, really, and be quite clear about what the expectations are on both sides. Yeah, so Yeah, I think there is a there's a middle ground. So, you know, you can spend a few years being a paraplanner and working in an advisor team. So you're being past clients, but also doing some of the paraplanning work as well. So there is a middle ground. I didn't think it necessarily has to be one or the other straight away. So, but, you know, there's definitely different alternatives for training and progressing people. But it, I think, you know, it would be like, you know, retraining to become an accountant or a solicitor or something. You know, I think a lot of, you know, it would be a big stretch for a lot of accountancy firms to just put someone through an academy on a high salary. So, I think it's the same thing in a lot of sectors. Yeah.
Solicitors as well, you know, and that's the thing that's missing. It's not being, you know, it's only recently being considered a profession, really, isn't it? So I think, I think over time will tell, there'll be structure to how you can go from uni to becoming a financial planner. And that's the thing that will start.
I think that is still a bit of an issue for firms and the industry. It's taking people from university and how you do that. It has changed though noticeably over the last few years for us and other firms. There's you know, we see very good candidates now. You just do. There's no shortage of decent candidates.
Yeah, especially around that level.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's just talk about some of the things. So when you're running your own business, you've got a million and one hats to wear. You sort of alluded to that in the very beginning. And it's very easy to get sucked into the things that take up your time but don't add any income to your business, okay? So what are you doing to generate new business, and what did you do to generate new business? Because I speak to a lot of financial planners, and a lot of them can dawdle, they can waste a lot of time, they can procrastinate on social media. But what's your advice about getting business on the board?
This is kind of pre-pandemic, but you've got to just get out there and put your face about, really, and you know, meet and greet people. When we started, I got up early, went to business breakfasts, you know, I chatted to a lot of people about what we were doing, and people were quite interested in it. You know, we said we're starting up our own business, you know, it's going to specialize in ethical and environmental investment. We've come from this background, and people actually wanted to support you. So I think you've got to have a bit of a story, and then be prepared to go out there and tell it. And people actually are quite supportive of new enterprises. You know, you'd be surprised. So, and some of it just happens by pure chance. I can remember going to someone's leaving do who worked at a law firm, and I got chatting to people there. One of them happened to be a finance director of a firm of accountants, and you know, I went out for coffee with him a couple of times, and all of a sudden he was becoming a client. He was passing clients to us. So it was just things like that, you know, just kind of happen if you're prepared to put the effort in. You can't, you know, so there's another cliche, but you can't just sit at your desk expecting it to turn up, because it's not going to happen. I guess it's a double-edged sword, but you've got social media. You know, you can get your presence and face out on online, which is you know, it's a big opportunity. But obviously there's a lot of people trying to do that as well, so I don't think there's any substitute for just going out and meeting people and talking to them about what you're doing and building a relationship with them that way. And I think you need to focus on, you know, a handful of people who you think might give you a lead in somewhere, or provide you with, you know, referrals. I think that would be a word of advice. Yeah. It's all very well having, you know, big ideas about, you know, creating some massive, you know, online presence, but the reality of that is it's extremely difficult.
I think so. I think you can go down a bit of a black hole when it comes to social media trial.
I think you can.
And you can spend a lot of money doing it as well.
You can. And it really is sort of hit and miss. So, you know, I think in this, especially with you know, our profession, people still buy people. Ultimately, that's what happens. If people trust you and like you, like talking to you, like spending time with you, you know, the chances are they'll do business with you. So
No,
makes
total sense. And one thing that always comes up with me as well, and I think in my head, if I was a financial planner, would I be going out and trying to win clients, first of all, or would I be trying to go out and generate referral relationships? Because some of the most successful financial planners that I've spoken to have got like opportunities for referrals at the highest level, you know, and they're well connected with accountants, solicitors. But I don't know, that's like a very traditional route, isn't it? Especially around private client, I suppose.
It is, and it's hard. It's hard. It's a hard route as well. You've got to put a lot of effort into cultivating those relationships, and you're going to be competing with others. You know, you're going to be competing with other firms. So, I would be doing both. I wouldn't back, you know, one route or another, really. But if you've got something you are interested in, or a link into some specific field, then I think that's worth concentrating on, like a different profession or a niche, something like that. You know, it could be, you know, doctors. It could be dentists. You know, it could be anything like that. But if you've got some route into a different profession, I think that's worth looking at as well. You know, and you've got to be prepared to ask for referrals. You just can't be shy about it.
I think what you mentioned there about the niche specialism as well, a niche interest in something, because traditionally it was always like, well, we work with accountants, we work with solicitors. You were sort of very early on adopter in respect of the ethical space. So that was your interest. So we could go into a room and you could talk about something that people probably weren't talking about deeply. I mean, it was very forward thinking. So it was very niche. It was very interesting. And also you're appealing to somebody's side, aren't you? So there's some people are going to be either very into ethical or even against it, but at least you've got the opportunity to challenge their thought process around it sway them otherwise. And people like that. When it's the same thing over and over again, if I was an accountant and I had a 10th financial planner this week asking me for referrals and it was the same kind of approach, it's boring, isn't it? When you look at some of the financial planners that I know now, like their niches are footballers, you know, so they work with football agents and that's where they get their referrals from. And then from those, they get entertainers. So they work in the entertainment market. So they start to branch out that way. I know people that focus purely on startup businesses in the ethical space, for example. I'm starting a company called Down to Earth, which is a recruitment company that specializes in renewable energies, so low energy renewable energy technology. And I mean, that, you know, some of the people we talk to are ridiculously wealthy. You know, like there's some money going around that space, isn't there? You know, and it's about understanding those individual little niches. Another girl I know who was from the fashion background, so she deals with a lot of high-end fashion designers and buyers and, you know, at the top level. But because she works in fashion, she can talk the game, you know? So it's about understanding what your strengths are and not just thinking accountants and solicitors, but also kind of, well, what can I bring to the table? And then that kind of also brings you onto your own personal brand and your branding. Now with social media being so accessible and you can just literally position yourself as an expert within a micro niche, connect with people instantly. You don't have to go and sit in a room and have breakfast with them. Bang, you know, you're in front of people talking about things you enjoy and you're being picked up and people are recognizing it and referrals should hopefully come in. I think with that sort of thing anyway, that space, you have to keep on plodding at it, don't you? You can't just sort of put it out there and hope it's going to come back to you.
You've got to be consistent, relentless about it. I think you can't just put it out there and think that's it. It's you've got to be focused and you know, you've got to be on it all the time.
What's your plans then? So over the next sort of 5 to 10 years, have you got a plan of action? Are you looking to take your company to 100 people, or what's your, have you got any goals? Do you set many goals? Or
yeah, we set goals. You know, we had to readjust those over the last year. Yeah, fortunately we've got through that so far, so good. But you know, we are looking to grow our business. You know, we're looking to take on advisors, especially with a client following. We're a B Corp, so we're looking to, you know, sort of work with that. And we've got a pedigree in ethical and environmental investment, so we're looking at our marketing at the moment to really look at ways of reinforcing that and putting the message out there. because you know, there's a lot of sort of new players in the field, but I think we've got something different and compelling to say. So you know, a big thrust of what we're doing over the next few years is really sort of building our presence, because we've done quite a lot of internal reorganization over the last year to make ourselves more efficient. And you know, over the next couple of years, that the push is going to be on you know, expanding the business.
I think one thing I would definitely do from the outside looking in, obviously being running a recruitment company, I focus a lot of time on looking at businesses. And I'm looking at from the outside. You might not look at your competitors as much as I do. So I did a search on ethical and impact investment planning, financial planning. And obviously I contacted you, didn't I? Because I had a candidate I thought would be a good fit for you. So there's only a handful of you. There was only a few of you. And some of the ones that I've spoken to are doing very little around marketing, but they're leading with that ethical approach or impact approach. And when you say you're looking to grow your business, I did the podcast with The Path recently, and they're an impact-focused financial planning firm, purely impact-focused.
Yeah, I've heard of them,
But that podcast alone generated so much inbound interest from financial planners wanting to be part of it, because they want to be part of a firm that has that ethos as well. And there isn't a great deal of you out there. So I think building your business with at the forefront being ethical and impact and talking about it, putting content out there religiously, it won't take much, because there isn't many people in your space doing it.
No.
You can dominate that niche really quickly.
Yeah. It's something that we are, you know, very, very mindful of. And we're looking to work closely with you know, a marketing professional. So there's stuff in the background going on, which hopefully is going to help sort of take us to the next level. Yeah,
fabulous. Because from the outside looking in, if you're going into that space and that's your focus, then crikey, you should be in a good place, because I think people are waking up to that, the impact that their investments are having on the world.
Well, there's a lot of stuff going on at the moment, you know, people being encouraged to look at what's in their pensions. You know, there's obviously Joe Biden being elected in the United States, I think has made everyone sort of more optimistic about, you know, what's going on with climate change, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, the whole sector is moving forward all the time. You know, there's 15 years ago, we were considered to be a bit of a an oddball, really, in some ways. But, you know, now it's you're an oddball if you don't think about it, I think. So it's kind of turned on its head.
No, absolutely. And I think, as people say, 27 times more effective than any other kind of carbon reducing structure, if you just restructure your pension plan.
You know, we and I think we're quite proud of some of the things that we our clients supported you know, in relatively early days. You know, these things have been up for a long time, producing renewable energy. You know, they're part of, you know, this country's you know, energy infrastructure. You know, this country now, I think, has decarbonized more of its grid faster than any other country in the world. So, you know, in our own way, we've played a small part in that, because there was a time when banks weren't funding those types of you know, enterprises and startups. So you know we had some clients who you know, wanted to support that kind of thing. So, you know, it has been you know, an exhilarating journey in some ways.
Fantastic. So just my final question, really, because I'm always interested to know, how many of your clients then, say, how much have we got under management? About 250 million, is that right?
No, it's nearer 500 million. Yeah.
Okay, there you go. That's the most recent bit I saw, 250.
Yeah,
so might want to take that down. So 500 million. So
it's always difficult whether you're saying under advice or under management. So altogether, under influence or however, it's about 500 million. Yeah.
About 500 million. And so how much of that is invested in ethical as opposed to not?
Good question. I think it's about 40% of it is invested in ethical, but it's growing a lot at the moment. We're finding a lot of clients are switching their portfolios from ethical or from conventional to ethical. And we're having debates in business about whether we want to, you know, encourage all clients to go down that route, you know, more emphatically, because we, you know, we think it's the right thing to do.
It's a good conversational piece, though, isn't it, to have with existing clients? And it's only going to go up, isn't it, really?
And, you know, with the new regulations around, you know, reporting and MiFID, it's something that you've got to discuss with clients, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, Stephen, it's a busy time of the year for you. Lots to do, lots of clients to see. So I don't want to take any more of your time, but I am really thankful for your time today, just to learn a little bit more about your business and your career so far. So I really appreciate it.
And, nice to talk to you, Sam. And if you want to catch up at any point in the future, then you know where I am.
Perfect. So,
great.
Sounds amazing, Stephen. Thank you so much for your time today. And take care. Cheers.
Cheers, Sam. Thanks.